University of California Television presents this podcast of City Club presents Doris Kearns Goodwin on Abraham Lincoln, recorded December 3rd, 2005 in San Diego, California. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
It is such a pleasure to be with you all tonight. Indeed, having loved history and libraries for as long as I can remember, I can't wait to tell you about the man that I have spent the last decade of my life with, Abraham Lincoln. You know, at first, when I decided that I wanted to study Lincoln, it required a leap of faith to hope that I could come up with a story that hadn't been told 100 times before. And at first I thought, well, maybe I'll try and do Abraham and Mary, as I had done Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt in No Ordinary Time. But as I got into the story itself, I realized that Mary couldn't carry the public side of the story the way Eleanor clearly could in the home front during World War II. And more than that, I began to realize that Abraham Lincoln was actually spending even more time and sharing emotions with his colleagues in the cabinet as they waited long hours in the telegraph office at night for news from the battlefront, sleeping oftentimes on the couch as he went to the front to visit the soldiers, as he relaxed with them at night. So in some ways, he was married to them more than he was to Mary. And then when I realized that these colleagues in the cabinet were actually the people who had run against him in 1860 for the Republican nomination, I realized about 2 years into this 10-year project that this was the story I wanted to tell, thus the title, Team of Rivals. But it still was scary for a little period after that, because it would be the first time I was ever going back into the 19th century. And in the 20th century, of course, you have access to interviews of people who have known the Kennedys or known the Roosevelts or been in the White House with them. And of course, when I was working on my book on Lyndon Johnson, I had the extraordinary privilege of having actually listened to him for hundreds of hours when I worked with him his last year in the White House and accompanied him to his ranch to help him on his memoirs those last years of his life. When he told me the most fabulous, colorful, anecdotal stories, I could have listened to him for hours. There was a problem with those stories I later discovered, which is that half of them weren't true, but they were great, nonetheless. So I had a feeling that part of the attraction that he had for me was that I loved listening to these tall tales. And I also worried that part of the attraction was that I was then a young woman. I was only 25 years old, and he had somewhat of a minor league Bill Clinton reputation with women. So I was constantly chattering to him about boyfriends, even when I didn't have them at various intervals. And it was all working perfectly until one day he said he wanted to discuss our relationship, which sounded very ominous, especially when he took me nearby to the lake, conveniently called Lake Lyndon Johnson. And there was wine and cheese and French bread and a red check tablecloth, all the romantic trappings. And he started out, "Doris, more than any other woman I have ever known," and my heart sank. And then he said, "You remind me of my mother." It was pretty embarrassing given what was going on in my mind. So by moving back into the 19th century, there would be no picnics by the lake with Abraham Lincoln. There'd be no interviews with people who had worked in the White House or known any of the people who were the cabinet colleagues. But I found something even more valuable, and that was that the people in Lincoln's generation kept voluminous diaries and wrote hundreds, if not thousands, of letters to their family, even during the midst of the Civil War. And I think there's nothing for an historian more valuable than being able to read a handwritten entry to a diary or a letter that was written where the raw emotions are usually there, of fear, of anger, of excitement, of treachery, of jealousy, as they write these letters to their families. Indeed, in the archives of the Seward family, Seward, who became Lincoln's Secretary of State, there were 5,000 family letters. And Seward had a daughter named Fanny who, when she was 16, decided she wanted to be a writer. So she pledged that she would never marry, thinking you couldn't combine those things at that time. And she kept this dazzling diary all through the Civil War until the war came to an end and she reached 21 years old and died of tuberculosis. But that diary is a treasure. And then Chase, who became his Secretary of the Treasury, kept a diary from the time he was 20 years old until days before he died. Bates, who became his Attorney General, had a charming diary over 3 decades. And Stanton, who became his Secretary of War, had a wife that he loved so much, when she died, he was so devastated by her death and thought that his 2-year-old child would never know the mother, so he wrote a 78-page letter detailing the whole romance that he had had with his wife so that the child would know his mother. So all of these sources just allow you really to catapult yourself back into another era better than almost anything. I wonder what will happen 200 years from now when people try to record our era. They'll have so much stuff, but they won't have that kind of an intimate art of letter writing that these people practiced so well at that time. So all of these sources really gave me an insight into Lincoln that I really hadn't seen before, because they talked about him on a daily basis. They would tell stories to their wives and children of what he had done that day. And I think what surprised me the most about the Lincoln who emerged from these wonderful sources was his vibrant personality. You know, I knew I respected him from the start. We all do. I knew he was the great emancipator, the great statesman. But what I hadn't counted on, really, was his remarkable sense of humor, his affability, and his good nature. I think those pictures that we see of him are so sad, the eyes. Nobody ever smiles in those 19th century pictures anyway. They used to say in order to have a photograph taken, you had to have your neck clamped to a chair so you wouldn't move. Little wonder that they didn't smile. And then, of course, he had that unfortunate beard that made him seem even more imposing. But what came through in all these entries was that he was the one, time and again, though he had had some depressive episodes when he was young, I think we've overdone this idea of his depression, because during the Civil War, he was the one, time and again, who sustained the spirits of his colleagues with his affability, his good nature, his kindness, his sensitivity, and his remarkable gift for storytelling. In fact, that gift for storytelling was really born, I think, when he was only a child. He tells the tale of when his father, they lived in a log cabin on a street, not a street, but a road, where people would come by, and peddlers, as they were walking by the cabin. They would often stop and tell stories to his father, and he said he couldn't go to bed at night until he could recast those stories in words that his friends on the field, as they worked the next day, could understand and listen to. And then he would climb on a tree stump and entertain them for minutes on end, probably learning the pleasure that an attentive audience brings, even at an early age. And then when he became a lawyer on the circuit in Illinois, in those days the lawyers would travel from one county courthouse to the next, traveling with the judge, the sheriff, the bailiff. Sometimes the prisoners would be roaming around. They would all stay in the same boarding house or the same tavern. And whenever it was known that Lincoln was in a particular place, people would come from miles around so they could hear him tell stories. He would stand in the tavern, it was said, with his back against a fire and entertain the crowd into the wee hours of the morning. And the great thing is that these stories were not quite what you might expect from our marble monument in Washington. Indeed, I'll tell you a couple of them, and I dare say you will not think of Lincoln in the same way again. One of his favorite stories had to do with the Revolutionary War hero, Ethan Allen. And it turned out that Ethan Allen went to Britain after the Revolutionary War, and the British people were still upset about losing the war, so they decided to embarrass him a little bit and tease him a little bit by putting a picture of George Washington in the outhouse where he would have to encounter it. And they figured he'd come out somewhat grumpily, but he went in the outhouse and he came out smiling, and they said, well, didn't you see George Washington there? Oh, yes, he said. I think it was the perfectly appropriate place for him. What do you mean, they queried. Well, he said, there's nothing to make an Englishman faster than the sight of General George Washington. So think of Lincoln that way. And then another story that he loved to tell about the Revolution as well had to do with an old man, maybe 80 or 90 years old, living decades after the Revolution, who had an obsession with any relic that the Revolution had provided. So he found out that there was an old lady, 90 years old, who had worn a particular dress when she was 16 years old in the Revolutionary War. So he decided to go and visit her, and he got her to bring the dress down from the attic, and she thought this was all rather foolish. She handed him the dress, however, and he kissed it. He was so excited. So the woman said to him, you know, listen, stranger, if you want to kiss something old, you better kiss my ass. It's 16 years older than that stupid dress. But his stories were not really only amusing. They were often had a practical wisdom that somehow was engaged in a humorous tale, or they were used to diffuse tensions before the worst cabinet meetings. He would often start a cabinet meeting with one of these stories, and you can imagine then that these colleagues that were feuding would somehow have to laugh. But I think what moved me the most about Abraham Lincoln was the depth and the nature of his ambition. Very early on, I believe, he understood that he possessed unusual talents, and he was burning with a desire to learn. And yet he was only able to attend school, as he later said, a few weeks here and a few weeks there, because schools in those days were subscription schools requiring a payment on the part of the family, and his family didn't put up the money. And his father would loan him out to various farmers in the fields to pay off various debts. So even when he was in school, he'd be pulled out. And he finally figured that he'd only gone to school 1 year, all total, of formal schooling. And yet, as we all know, he scoured the countryside for books and read everything he could lay his hand on. It was said when he obtained a copy of the King James Bible or Aesop's Fables that his eyes would sparkle. He couldn't sleep. He couldn't eat. The poet Emily Dickinson once said, "There is no frigate like a book to take us lands away." And in many ways, that's what happened to Lincoln. Though he never would travel to Europe, he went with his beloved Shakespeare's kings to England. He went with Lord Byron's poetry to Spain and Portugal. In many ways, literature allowed him to transcend his surroundings, which makes him a perfect subject, really, for the Great Writers series. There were so many losses, however, in his early life that he was haunted by death. His mother died when he was only 10 years old, and then his father left Abe and his sister Sarah, who was only 12, for several months on end while he went back to Kentucky to bring back another wife. They lived in a region where Lincoln later said the wild panther would scream, a very, very undeveloped part of the country. And when the stepmother and his father came back, they were living so raggedly that the stepmother thought they looked like wild animals. And then his beloved sister died only a few years later in childbirth. His first love, Anne Rutledge, died at 22 years old. And it was said at the time, somebody said to him, "Well, don't you believe you'll see all these people in an afterlife later?" And he said very sadly, I wish I would believe that, but I'm not sure that I do. And he couldn't bear the idea that when you die, you simply become dust. So he somehow seemed to adopt the ancient Greek notion that you could live on if you accomplished deeds that were worthy enough to be remembered by the generations. If you somehow left life better for the people around you, then your story would be told after you died. And I believe that deep, worthy ambition became his lodestar, carrying him through his long life. It carried him through his one serious depression when he was in his early 30s, when it seemed like three things had come together to make him so sorrowful. He had broken his engagement with Mary Todd Lincoln, not being sure he was ready to get married. He was knowing that his greatest friend, Joshua Speed, was leaving Illinois to go back to Kentucky because his father had died. And his political career seemed on a downslide because the state of Illinois had gone into a recession. He was in the state legislature, and he was blamed in part for his support for public works projects, which had helped to bankrupt the state. And in that mood, people were so worried that he was so sad that they took all knives and razors from his room, fearing he was suicidal. His great friend Joshua Speed went to his side and said, "Lincoln, you must rally or you will die." He said, "I would just as soon die now, but I have not yet done anything to make anyone remember that I have lived." And somehow that ambition carried him out of his depression back into the state legislature. It carried him through his single term in Congress, which was very troubled for him because it turned out that he questioned the rationale for the Mexican-American War. You may feel some analogy. He argued that the president had instigated the war for purposes that were different from the actual purposes that he led us into the war. But at that time, the Mexican-American War was very popular, and Lincoln's anti-war stance meant that he probably could not have run for Congress again had he tried. But this ambition was so much larger than just office or power that it carried him through two failed races for the Senate, not stopping with the first failure, not stopping with the second failure. He then ran for the Republican nomination for the presidency in 1860, though he was considered the least likely to win. And remarkably, once he did win, which was, I think, in part because he worked harder than everyone else, was shrewder than the other candidates. The convention, he was the one who maneuvered to have it held in Chicago, where he could then pack the hall with his own supporters. He had made no enemies in his long life, where all the other leading candidates had made enemies all along the line. So his strategy was that if you have to give up your first love, come to me as the second love. He never said anything bad about any of the other candidates so that no one felt when they had to go to him that he had undone them in the long run. But I think most importantly, there was the character of him that was unbeknownst to the other people that had slowly, slowly, slowly worked himself through his speeches, through his dazzling writing star, into somebody that they could trust if they turned the Republican Party over to him. The other two candidates, Seward and Chase, far better known, but they were seen as too radical, too liberal. And on the other side, Bates was seen as too conservative, and Lincoln stood in the middle of the party, not because he positioned himself there, but because by temperament, that is where he was. So I couldn't wait when I learned that these people were so interesting, Seward and Chase and Bates and later Stanton, to learn about their life stories as well as Lincoln's, knowing that he was surrounded by them during his entire White House time. But I suspect an additional reason for my desire to focus on the colleagues and not just look at Lincoln in a flat term was the great pleasure I had had in focusing on the colleagues that surrounded Roosevelt during World War II, where he made the White House in World War II almost the most exclusive residential hotel you could possibly imagine. In fact, on that second floor of the White House during the war lived Winston Churchill, who had come for weeks at a time to America, living in a bedroom diagonally across from Roosevelt's. Indeed, they would stay up so late at night drinking and smoking that Eleanor would have to go into their office and say, "Isn't it time for you two boys to go to bed?" And then there was Missy LaHand, Roosevelt's secretary, who loved him since she was 18, lived with the family in the White House. And then there was Lorena Hickok, who loved Eleanor and lived in a bedroom next to Eleanor's. And then there was Harry Hopkins, his foreign policy advisor, who came for dinner one night early in the war, slept over, and did not leave until the war came to an end. And then there was Princess Martha, a beautiful princess from Norway in exile in America during the war, who lived with the family on the weekends. So I kept imagining what fabulous conversations all of these people must have had at night in their bathrobes as they gathered in the corridor that surrounds the bedroom suites up there on the second floor of the White House. And I kept wishing that when I'd been up there with Lyndon Johnson, I thought of asking, where did Eleanor sleep? Where was Franklin Roosevelt? Where was Harry Hopkins? But of course, I wasn't thinking in those terms when I was 25 years old. So I happened to mention this on a radio program in Washington, and it happened that Hillary Clinton was listening. So she promptly called me up at the radio station and invited me to sleep overnight in the White House. She said we could then wander the corridor together and figure out where everyone had slept 50 years earlier. So 2 weeks later, with my map in hand, she invited us to a state dinner, after which, between midnight and 2 a.m., we went through every room up there and figured out, yes, Chelsea Clinton is sleeping where Harry Hopkins once was, Bill Clinton is sleeping where FDR was, and most importantly, I was sleeping in Winston Churchill's bedroom. There was no way I could sleep. I was certain he was sitting in the corner drinking his brandy and smoking his ever-present cigar. In fact, that bedroom is the scene of my favorite story in World War II, which is that when Churchill came there shortly after Pearl Harbor, he and Roosevelt were set to sign a document that put the Allied nations against the Axis powers, but the Allied nations were calling themselves then the Associated Nations, and no one liked the word. So early that morning, Roosevelt awakened with the whole new idea of calling themselves the United Nations. He was so excited, he had himself wheeled into Churchill's bedroom to tell him the news. But it so happened Churchill was just coming out of the bathtub and had absolutely nothing on. So Roosevelt said, "I'm so sorry, I'll come back in a few moments." Churchill, however, ever able to speak spontaneously in a very formal voice, said, "Oh no, please stay. The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States." Can you imagine that you're dripping from the tub and your stomach is sticking out and you can say something like that? So that night, as soon as the President and Mrs. Clinton left, I couldn't wait to go in the bathtub, and then I truly felt I was in the presence of the greatness of the past. But going back to that other century, focusing on Lincoln's colleagues, I think, has given me a story of intrigue, of treachery, and surprising friendship, because each of these men thought they should have been president instead of the single-term congressman. They were governors and senators, college graduates, and yet in the end, they all came to respect Abraham Lincoln. And not only did they think they were a rival of Lincoln's, but they were rivals of one another, because the young Republican Party had come from former Democrats, former Whigs, Liberty Party people, Free Soilers. So many of them hated one another, wouldn't even talk to one another during cabinet colleague meetings, and in fact would call each other liar, thief, scoundrel. But somehow Lincoln made all of them work together as an unusual team. And in the end, they helped him to carry the country through the Civil War. So I'd just like to tell you a little bit about these main characters, because they are all larger than life, larger than almost anyone on our political scene today, which shows how big Abraham Lincoln was to have come in and mastered them all. Seward, in some ways, became my favorite of his colleagues. He was a Churchillian kind of character, just as Churchill. He loved to drink much of the day. He loved his Havana cigars. He was very outgoing. He had legendary dinner parties in the 1850s, where he would invite Southerners as well as Northerners, even as the country was falling apart, but served them so many courses, 17 courses, and so much liquor and 5 different wines, that by the end, they said they were purple with the mellowness of wine. He was the clear front runner. He was the anti-slavery orator that everybody knew in the 1850s, and everybody thought he would be the Republican nominee. He was waiting at his house in Auburn, New York for the news. 10,000 people had gathered on his lawn to wait and hear that he would, and celebrate. The champagne had already been shipped into the restaurants. When the telegraph officer brought the news that on the first ballot he was ahead, the second ballot he was ahead, but on the third ballot, Abraham Lincoln had won, it seemed an irrecoverable disappointment. And yet when Lincoln made him his Secretary of State, he thought, oh, well, I'll be the Prime Minister. Lincoln will be a figurehead. But in fact, within a matter of months, he came to understand that Lincoln was unlike anyone he had ever known. And the two men not only became partners, not only became allies, they became great friends. Lincoln loved nothing more than going over to Seward's mansion at Lafayette Park across from the White House. And he would sit with his legs up on a table as Seward was drinking and smoking, and they would talk of all manner of things beyond the war, allowing Lincoln to relax and replenish his energies. They traded stories. They loved Shakespeare together. They went to the theater more than 100 times during Lincoln's presidency. Lincoln said he loved nothing more than to sit in the theater and have the lights go down and imagine himself back at the time of Shakespeare. So that friendship, I really loved traveling through the arc of it in this story. And then almost opposite in personality to Seward was Chase, who became Lincoln's Secretary of the Treasury. He was a deeply religious man, a deeply priggish kind of man in a sense. He thought drinking and smoking and novels and theaters were all sinful, and he refused to engage in any of them. So he spent his evenings, it was said, practicing jokes that he could never deliver with ease, trying stories out that he could never remember the end of, and writing in that ever-present diary. But he had a relentless drive for the presidency. It was rather sad, in a sense, because he had accomplished so much in his life. He had been, they considered, the Attorney General for the Negro in the 1830s and 40s. He defended so many runaway slaves. He became the governor and senator of Ohio, Secretary of Treasury under Lincoln, and did a fabulous job at that. But because he never reached his goal of being president, he felt like his life had been a failure. His drive was for office and power, not for the accomplishments themselves, which is what left him, ultimately, a sadder man. I believe in some ways that relentless drive came from the void in his personal life that resulted from devastating personal losses. He married his first wife, and she died in childbirth, and he loved her passionately. At the age of 22, she died. The little girl born from that birth lived only until 5 years old, and then she died. He then married again, and his second wife died at 25 of tuberculosis, and his third wife died in her early 30s, and he never married again. So he put all of his love and energy into a daughter from that second marriage named Kate. He sent her to an expensive boarding school in New York from the age of 7 to 17 so she could learn classics and literature and history and letter writing and conversation so that she could become the first lady of the land, in many ways his surrogate wife. She adored her father, so much so that when she came back to Washington, she was considered the most beautiful woman, the most fascinating woman of her age. Poets wrote poetry about her. Mary Lincoln hated her because she had a rival court to the White House during those Civil War years. She could have had anybody she wanted to marry, but she chose a multimillionaire, a guy who was much older than she, in order to further her father's political ambitions. And sadly for beautiful Kate, the marriage turned out devastating. He was an alcoholic, he abused her, and much, much later, long after her father had died, never having achieved his desire for the presidency, she ended up in poverty, dying sadly and alone. So that story had its own interesting arc that really became a drama in its own self. And then in opposition to the story of Chase was Edward Bates, who became his attorney general, because early in life, he had had very great political ambitions himself. He was in the Missouri State Convention that drafted the Missouri Constitution. He was in the state legislature and then was elected to Congress as a young man. But in the meantime, he fell in love with his wife, Julia Coulter, and he could not bear being away from her. So on his way to Congress, I found the letters that he wrote to her questioning, why am I going? If you go to Congress in those days, you're away for 8-9 months, given how long the travel is. And he wrote to her saying he couldn't sleep well or he couldn't eat well at night without her presence, that he felt this continuing, restless, indefinable feeling. And as a result, he began to diminish his political ambitions, not really wanting to go back to Congress after that, not accepting various cabinet posts that he was offered. He just wanted to be, he said, with his beloved Julia. Well, he wasn't away from her very long, it seems, because in the end they had 17 children. So they managed to be together some of the time, one would say. But when 1860 rolled around, he finally agreed that he would stand for the presidency because the country was falling apart, and people thought maybe because he came from a border state, because he had originally come from Virginia and originally had slaves, that he might hold the country together. When Lincoln won that nomination, though, he did agree to come on as Attorney General, And at the time, he thought Lincoln was a decent man, but he wasn't sure he would be a very good leader. He had so little experience. By the end, he concluded that Lincoln was the best leader he had known and very nearly a perfect man. But the most remarkable transformation, I think, took place between Edwin Stanton and Abraham Lincoln. They had met in the 1850s as lawyers. Stanton was a nationally celebrated lawyer, very wealthy, very well known in his craft, and he had a very important patent case to try. And it was supposed to be tried in Illinois. He came from Ohio. So he sent his partner to find some lawyer in Illinois who could be of counsel in case they needed some help with the judges in Illinois. They came and looked at Lincoln. They decided he'd be okay. And Lincoln was so excited. He was so thrilled at the idea of meeting Stanton and working on this nationally famous case. But then in the middle of the case, it got transferred from Illinois to Ohio, so they didn't really need Lincoln anymore, but they neglected to tell him. So all summer he had worked on the brief. He gets to Cincinnati, and he goes right up to Stanton in his typically friendly way, and he said, "Oh, let's go up to the courthouse together." It is said that when Stanton took one look at him with his disheveled hair, his trousers up too high, his socks sticking out, he said to his partner, "We've got to get rid of," and he called him a long-armed ape. And he never looked at the brief that Lincoln had prepared. They went to the courthouse without him. They never sat with him at the boarding house. Lincoln said when he left Cincinnati after that week that he never even wanted to go back to the city again. It had been such a sad experience. And yet, almost unimaginably, 6 years later, after Lincoln's first Secretary of War, Cameron, failed, everybody came to him and said, "Stanton is the man for this job. He's brilliant, he's tough, he's really difficult to deal with, he's passionate, but he will be the guy who will be your Secretary of War." And Lincoln somehow was able to put that past hurt behind him, put those grudges behind him, so rare in public life when you think so many politicians live to pay back grudges from the past. And he made Stanton his Secretary of War, and the two of them became so close that Stanton ended up loving him more than anyone outside of his family. Now, they argued consistently. They would argue particularly about pardons. Lincoln always wanted to pardon a soldier if he could. He said he could go to sleep at night knowing he had saved somebody's life. Because in those days, if you fell asleep on checkpoint duty or if you ran away from battle, the crime would be punished by hanging. So Lincoln would be pardoning a soldier who fell asleep, saying it wasn't his fault. Sleep just caught him unawares. Or somebody who ran away from battle, he would say, "Well, it wasn't that his heart wasn't courageous, it was that his legs were the problem." And meanwhile, Stanton would come in and say, "You're destroying military discipline, you can't do this." And they would argue over and over again. But in the end, as I say, they were an odd couple, but great working partners. So what were the qualities that allowed these men to be so drawn to Lincoln? I believe the key to his political genius rested on a series of emotional strengths that are rarely found in political life, but in some ways are so simple, because if politics is all about human relationships, as it is, then these kind of strengths that he had should be the first-rate strengths that any great politician would have. I think his most remarkable strength in the first place was a profound empathy. He somehow was able to understand, almost like he absorbed the feelings of people on all sides of the political spectrum, the feelings of the Southerners as well as the Northerners. And it started when he was even a young man. He was asked to address a temperance society. And the temperance organizations in those days were so passionate, much like the abortion debate is today. And the temperance organizers and the advocates would argue that those people who drank were capable of evil, and they were the source of all misery in the land. And Lincoln went before them, and he said, "You're never going to reach the drinkers if you talk about them that way. Denunciation leads to denunciation. Anathema leads to anathema. It's the nature of man," he said, "if he is so shunned, to retreat within himself. You've got to try to reach the heart of these people who drink through reason, through talking to them, through trying to provide an alternative." And that became in some ways the template for all of his speeches later. His first great anti-slavery speech in the 1850s, unlike the other anti-slavery orators who would criticize the Southerners as evil, unchristian men, he said they are what we would be in our situation. If we had slavery still in the North, we wouldn't know what to do with it instantly. If they did not have slavery in the South now, they would not introduce it. I will not blame them for doing what I do not know what to do. And obviously, in that beautiful second inaugural, he carried this to a dazzling peak. When at the verge of the North winning the war, no celebratory speech. On the contrary, he argued that the sin of slavery had been shared by both sides. And he said, "Both sides read the same Bible, both pray to the same God, both invoke his aid against the other. Neither's prayers have been fully answered." And then that wonderful closing line, with malice toward none and charity toward all, let us bind up the nation's wounds. So empathy, I think, was his central character. But also, he was so quick to acknowledge error whenever he made a mistake. He said, you have to learn from the mistakes you made. He wrote to a general saying, who had made a mistake, I frequently make mistakes in the things I have to do hastily. The thing is not to look backward, but to acknowledge the mistake and move over and learn from that. When he was angry with somebody, he would write a hot letter and put it aside until his emotions had cooled, instead of berating a subordinate in any way in public. In fact, when General Meade failed to follow up with General Lee after Gettysburg, he wrote him a letter because he said, I was so immeasurably distressed. If you had gone after Lee's army, this war might have come to a close, and as it is now, it's going to go on for a long period of time. But he realized how much it would hurt the general, so he put it aside, and it was found decades later in his papers, never sent, never signed. In all these ways, he was able to repair injured feelings that might have escalated into lasting animosity. Now, the other thing that I think was so rare was that he would shoulder responsibility for the failures of his subordinates. When his first Secretary of War, Cameron, was about to be censured by the Congress because in the early days of the war he had let contracts out to suppliers through middlemen who made off with scandalous profits, and then the weapons that were produced fell apart and didn't work during the early days of the war, so it was seen as if it was somehow Cameron's fault. Lincoln stood up for his beleaguered Secretary of War and said if anyone was to be at blame, it was him and his entire cabinet, because there was such chaos in the early days of the war, they had to get the Union Army supplied, so they did put out some unfortunate contracts, but it wasn't Cameron's fault. Cameron said no one else would have stood up for him at a time when everybody was piling on him, that it took an unusual man, but Lincoln was that unusual man. And then after each battle was lost, what he was able to do was immediately get himself onto a boat or a train to go to the front. He knew he had to see his soldiers immediately, even if it meant being in the midst of the battle itself. He went more than a dozen times to the front during his presidency, walking amongst the thinned ranks of the soldiers, visiting the wounded in the hospital, telling them stories which then they would tell to 100 more people, and just bolstering their morale. And then in turn, his being with them bolstered his morale, and he could come back and write a public letter to the country, which was one of the communications at that time, or give one of his extraordinary speeches that would give meaning to the war. None more extraordinarily, of course, than the Gettysburg Address, where he understood that he had to give a purpose that was larger than the war itself, and that purpose was to protect, of the people, by the people, for the people, this great democratic experiment, so that these soldiers had not, indeed, died in vain. And as a president, he understood the importance to stay in touch with people at all levels. I mean, the White House was much more a people's house then than it has been in recent decades. Anybody who wanted a job actually could roam into the White House, stand on a line, knock on Lincoln's door and say, give him his life story and say, I'd like a particular job in the customs house. And Lincoln's secretaries, Nicolay and Hay, would go to him and say, Lincoln, you don't have time to talk to these people. And he said, I have to listen to their life stories. They are my public opinion baths. I've got to remember the popular assemblage from which I have come. I think one of the difficulties of our modern presidencies, in the second term in particular, is that presidents have lost touch with the ordinary people, and so have their aides. Life in that White House is so much of a cocoon in these recent decades that feeling that you need to keep as president with what people are feeling and thinking is often very hard to get. But Lincoln made sure that he understood that. So in the end, I think his story shows that in the hands of a truly great politician, the qualities that we normally associate with decency and morality, things like kindness and sensitivity, compassion and empathy, can be truly great political resources, and it is what made him a political genius. So you can imagine, after living with this wonderful character for the decade that I did, it was hard to bring his life story to an end. It was especially hard to write about those last weeks of his life, when on the one hand, he knew that he had brought the war to a successful conclusion. He knew that the Union would be preserved. He knew that his Emancipation Proclamation had been followed up by a constitutional amendment that he had gotten through Congress with Lyndon Johnson-esque shouldering and patronage and arm-twisting on the Hill. He was great at that point, and it was on its way to the States to end slavery forever. And yet I knew that he was only going to have a matter of weeks to feel the serenity that he felt in those last days, because he would be killed by John Wilkes Booth. Indeed, on that last afternoon of his life, he invited Mary Lincoln for a carriage ride so they could talk about the future. Theirs had been a quite turbulent marriage, although I'm convinced that when they first met, they were really well suited for one another. Mary came from a wealthy family, so in that sense they were very opposite, but she loved reading, she loved poetry, she could memorize large passages of Shakespeare's plays, as could he, and she loved politics, which was quite unladylike at that time. She made the highest marks in school, she had a very good education, and she was very extrovertish and a great conversationalist. And she tells the story that when they first met, she was surrounded by a bunch of beaux at her sister's house in Springfield, and he came up to her and he said, "Mary, I want to dance with you in the very worst way." And then she laughingly said, "He certainly did." He was rather awkward around women at that time. But nonetheless, they did get married. I think she was his partner in many ways through the 1850s. But once she got into the White House, there was really no footing on which she could stand. Nobody trusted her. The North thought that she was a traitor because she had four stepbrothers coming from Kentucky, as she did, who were in the Confederate Army. The Southerners distrusted her because she was married to Abraham Lincoln. The Eastern establishment looked upon her with scorn and condescension because she came from the West. And so there was no way that she really was able to find herself in that role of First Lady. And then all of the sadness that she had had partly during her life, she had a somewhat mercurial temperament, her mother having died when she was young, it was said she was either in the attic or in the cellar in her moods, came to a crashing halt when her beloved son Willie died in February 1862 in the midst of the Civil War, when typhoid came screaming through Washington. She had four children. One child had died earlier at 3 years old. Her oldest son, Robert, was at Harvard College at the time during the Civil War. And there were two little boys in the White House, Willie at 10 and Tad at 8, who were really the light of the White House, full of energy, all sorts of schemes. Everybody loved having them around. And Willie, it was said, possessed the qualities of Lincoln. He wrote poetry even at 10 years old, incredibly kind and sensitive, took care of his little brother Tad, who had a speech defect, so that no one outside the family could understand what he was saying. When Willie died, Mary took to her bed, couldn't come out for months, essentially, and sadly for Tad, couldn't even bear being with Tad because he reminded her of Willie, which meant that all the mothering of Tad was then thrown on Lincoln's shoulders, and he became both mother and father to that little boy. But on the last day of Lincoln's life, he said to Mary, "You know, between the loss of our beloved Willie and the losses of the war, we have been so miserable for so long. We must now begin to look forward to life again." And they began to look back to the days in Springfield when happier times and remember certain parts of those memories. And they began to plan for what they wanted to do in the future. Lincoln's dream was to come over the Rockies to California. That's the first thing he wanted to do when his presidency was over. Mary wanted to go to Europe, and they both wanted to go to the Holy Land. So they began to plan all these wonderful trips, which made the events of that evening even sadder to contemplate when I thought about that. I don't think I had fully absorbed the extent of John Wilkes Booth's plot against Lincoln that night, because not only was he planning to kill Lincoln, but he had two co-conspirators. The second one was supposed to kill Andrew Johnson, the vice president. Fortunately for Johnson, he went to a hotel beforehand, got drunk and chickened out, and never did reach his target. But the third conspirator was supposed to kill Seward, and he nearly accomplished his task, leaving a bloody massacre in Seward's house. What happened is he came to the house under the guise of bringing medicine to Seward, who'd been in a very serious carriage accident the week before and broken his jaw and was up in his bed. He got to the top of the stairs where he encountered Seward's son. What was amazing is there were a dozen people in the house, and when you hear what happened, it's just incredible that it happened. He gets to the top of the stairs, and he gets to Seward's son, and Seward's son said, "No, you're not going in. He's asleep. I'll bring the medicine in." He takes his revolver, puts it right at the head of Seward's son's head, but it misfires, but then he takes the blunt edge of the revolver and cracks his skull with such force that his brain was exposed, and he fell unconscious for days. He then ran into the bedroom with a huge Bowie knife, and he slashed Seward's other son and the soldier nurse who was taking care of Seward, and then gets to Seward's side, and he plunges the knife so deep into Seward's neck and with such force into his face that he sheared his entire cheek off. The blood was such that he fell unconscious. Somehow, however, after many, many months, Seward did eventually recover. But meanwhile, John Wilkes Booth entered the back of the presidential box at Ford's Theater and put the bullet in the back of Lincoln's head. The doctor said he should have died instantly. The wound was that devastating. But so extraordinary was his life force that he fought on and lingered on until 7:22 a.m. the following morning, when Stanton echoed the words that have now come down through the generations, "Now he belongs to the ages." So that dream that had powered Lincoln from his earliest days, taken him through all the early losses in his family life, through those early failures in his political career, that dream to accomplish something that would stand the test of time, that would allow his story to be told, had indeed been realized. But even Lincoln could never have imagined how far his name would eventually travel. I was so thrilled when I was trying to figure out how to end the book and not wanting to end it simply on the sad note of the assassination, when one day I found this amazing article where an interview was made with Leo Tolstoy, the great Russian novelist. In 1908, it was published in the New York World, and Tolstoy told of a remarkable journey he had made a few years prior to a remote area of the Caucasus where there were a bunch of rude barbarians who had hardly ever ventured beyond their land and knew very little of civilized life beyond what they knew. So they asked Tolstoy to tell stories of the great men of history. So Tolstoy said he sat down and he told them all about Napoleon and Frederick the Great and Alexander, and they were so excited. But before he finished, they said, "But you haven't told us about the greatest ruler of all. We want to hear about that man who spoke with a voice of thunder, that man who laughed like the sunrise, that man who comes from that place called America, which is so far from here that if we should journey there as a young man, we would be old men when we got there. Tell us of Abraham Lincoln." Tolstoy said he was stunned to know that they had somehow heard of the great deeds of Abraham Lincoln. So he told him everything he could know about Lincoln's life story, about his birth in the log cabin, his poverty, his movement into the presidency, and his emancipation of the slaves. And he then asked himself, well, why was it that Lincoln was a greater leader than all these others? He wasn't a great general like Napoleon. He wasn't a great statesman like Frederick the Great. But Tolstoy concluded that his greatness was possessed in his greatness of character and in the moral fiber of his person, and I would agree with that. And in fact, incredibly, in 1908, Tolstoy predicted that we were still too near his greatness to understand him. It would take two centuries more before people would understand the man who had walked in that midst. So that meant that Lincoln's dream had certainly been realized. But when I think about it, for most of us, the hope to have our story told after we die is realized not through marble monuments in Washington, but most likely through our family and our friends and through our children and their children in turn, which brings me back at the end to where my own love of history truly began, with my own family and particularly with my father, and particularly to the days, which some of you know because I love baseball so much, when I was only 6 years old, and where my love of history began when he taught me that mysterious art of keeping score while listening to baseball games so that I could record for him the history of that afternoon's Brooklyn Dodger game. Now, when you're only 6 years old and your father comes home every single night, and I now realize that I, in excruciating detail, recounted every single play of every inning of the game that had just taken place that afternoon, but he made me feel I was telling him a fabulous story. To keep your father's attention when you're 6 years old for 2 hours is such a great treat that it made me feel there was something magic about history. In fact, I'm convinced I learned the narrative art from those nightly sessions with my father, because at first I'd be so excited I would blurt out, "The Dodgers won," or "The Dodgers lost," which took much of the drama of this two-hour telling away. So I finally learned you had to tell a story from beginning to middle to end. Much later, I read an essay by my heroine, Barbara Tuchman, who said, even if you're writing about a war, you have to imagine to yourself as a narrative historian that you do not know how that war ended, so you can carry your reader with you every step along the way. So in some ways, I just learned that instinctively as a kid, trying to keep my father's attention. But in many ways, even though my father died when I was still in my 20s, once I had my three sons, I passed his memory, as well as my love of baseball, onto those boys. Indeed, even now, when I sit at Fenway Park with our season tickets, when the Dodgers left Brooklyn, I left the Dodgers, and when I went to Fenway Park, became an irrational Red Sox fan. And I can sit there now with our season tickets sometimes and close my eyes against the sun and imagine myself a young girl once more in the presence of my father with the players of my youth on the grassy fields below. Roy Campanella, Pee Wee Reese, Jackie Robinson, Duke Snider. I must say there is magic in these moments. When I open my eyes and I see my sons in the place where my father once sat, I feel an invisible loyalty and love linking my sons to the grandfather whose face they never had a chance to see, but whose heart and soul they have come to know through the countless stories I have told. Which is why in the end I shall always be grateful for this love of history which has led me to a lifetime looking back into the past, allowing me to believe that the past remains alive within every single one of us, that the private people we have loved and lost in our families and the public figures we have respected in our history, as Abraham Lincoln wanted to believe, really can live on so long as we pledge to tell and to retell the stories of their lives. Thank you for letting me do that with you tonight. Thank you. very much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Two last questions. The president believes that he is greatly victimized by the press. I'm not asking you to go into that, but I would like you to comment on whether Mr. Lincoln thought he was victimized by the press.
Oh, I think every president thinks he's victimized by the press. I mean, I remember my husband worked in John Kennedy's administration. I think there were times when he tore up papers, wouldn't take the Herald Tribune anymore. Certainly Lyndon Johnson, you know, would throw things at the television when something came on that he didn't like. I think it's a natural antagonism between a president and the press. And there's nothing that can be done with that except to remember that in a country, the free press is important. I think it's important for them to be able to fight back if something is factually wrong. And it's important to be able to get your own story out. And that's always going to happen. But I think that it's inevitable that a president wants the stories to be perfectly what they want to get out there. And the spin is so much greater even now than it was before. And the press wants to tell the story the way they want to. So that adversarial relationship will be there as long as possible. But as one says, in a democracy, it's a very healthy thing. As long as the press focuses on the issues that really matter. You know, I guess one of the things that saddens me is I really thought after September 11th that we had been jolted out of the kind of distractions that so preoccupied us in the 1990s. You know, when you think about those stupid trials that we listened to so long, and I remember, you know, Gary Condit and then later Monica Lewinsky or O.J. Simpson, we don't have time as a country to allow ourselves to be entertained to death, which I think is some comment that one of the commentators made. And I thought September 11th had jolted us out of that. And I think when I look back on September 11th, I think the saddest thing I think is that it was possible for the president to go an entirely different tack than the one that he eventually took, which was that, you know, when Roosevelt was faced with Pearl Harbor, he understood that he could no longer be just a liberal democratic leader. He had to become a true bipartisan leader. So he said, Dr. New Deal has to become Dr. Win the War. And with that, he brought two Republicans into his cabinet, Stimson and Knox. He went to the business community. He knew that only they could build the ships and the tanks and the weapons. And he forged an incredible partnership with the business community with whom he'd been at loggerheads during the 1930s. He gave antitrust regulations and he diminished them. He gave guaranteed profits. And they built the ships, tanks, and the weapons that served our allies in all the corners of the world. He knew that he had to mobilize the home front to continue that war's morale. So he had auxiliary fire and police, he had war bonds, he had blood drives, he had shared sacrifice in the form of rationing so that people would feel connected to the war, he had aluminum drives and rubber scrap drives, and of course he had a draft so that everybody knew somebody overseas and all the people working in the factories, which meant that the whole war was felt by the country at large. Now the war on terror is very different, so it was a much different challenge. But yet I keep wondering what might have been possible if President Bush had said, I'm now going, and he did for a while become a bipartisan leader, there's no question about that, but if he'd used that strength of the country wanting to be involved in this war, he could have also, I think, done auxiliary fire and police to prepare us for an emergency, which might have put us in good stead when Katrina happened. I've often thought he could have expanded the public health service, which would have been a good in itself, and at the same time would have protected us potentially against a biological attack. He could have called on more people to join the Peace Corps and the Teacher Corps to study cultures and study new languages and to go into the Army, had a real recruitment drive, which would have put us in good stead when we needed more soldiers when we were in Iraq. All of those things, I think, would have been possible and would have mobilized the home front. And most importantly, I think, it might have been a time for shared sacrifice if he had put forward a real goal of energy independence from Middle Eastern oil. We would have probably been willing to make some moves toward hybrid cars or whatever. It would have been on a much greater scale than we have been otherwise. And, you know, whether or not it was not just President Bush, whether our political parties nowadays are capable of that kind of working together, there is this red-blue problem that we have in our states. There is such an antagonism in the Congress, worse, I think, than any time in these last 10 or 12 or 15 years than it was even before. I mean, I'm not making light of the fact that they used to shoot each other in the Senate in the old days in Lincoln's time, so we shouldn't look too nostalgically back at that time. But I do think that everything is point-counterpoint today. The people who get on television are the ones that have the most extreme. The primaries reward the people on the extremes. And the people in the middle, as Abraham Lincoln, have a much harder time making it into our politics today. And all of that, I think, is something that we need to think about in very, very serious fashion.
Before I ask the last question, I want to take this opportunity to thank each of you for coming, for sharing your Saturday night with us. I want to thank Mr. Moores, Mr. Alderson, and Ms. Tedrow for their help, and for the wonderful women from the library who assisted, and Mr. Guzman. Thank you all. Thank you, Mark. You're going to be signing books. The books have been signed, but if they want them personalized, you're willing to do that. If you didn't get a book and you want a book, this is your opportunity. The last question is, you have given 10 years of your life to Abraham Lincoln. How has that changed you? Has it changed you? How has it influenced you?
You know, it's interesting. I mean, each topic, I suppose, affects you in a certain way. I mean, certainly Lyndon Johnson, when I was with him at the end of his life and saw how sad he was because politics had been taken away from him, it made me realize that that kind of success, unless you're balanced by other things that matter to you in your life, there was so little he could do in his retirement because he didn't care about anything else except politics, that I sometimes think he willed himself to die. And that made me realize as a young person that just ambition without balancing it with family, with friends, with sports, with things you care about, isn't worth it. So that was a huge life lesson that I think I learned from him. I suppose in some ways what I learned from the Kennedy family saga when my own children were young, when I saw the enormous numbers of deaths that took place in that family, children dying before the parents, was just to savor the life of your young children and spend time with them because you never knew what was going to happen. It made me just more aware, I think, of life's misfortunes because of the Kennedy story. And then I suppose with the Roosevelts, what was so telling was that Franklin and Eleanor's relationship was one that needed forgiveness and needed forgetfulness, just as many of our marriages do. I mean, he had a relationship with a young woman, Lucy Mercer, when they had been married for 12 years, and he and Eleanor did stay together, but she was never able really to forgive him for that. And sadly, I think it meant that though they were so well suited for each other, though they were so respectful of one another and affectionate, the love that they had once had never was recaptured. And I remember when I was working on it, I wanted to say, Eleanor, he loves you. I know he does. Just get back with him. And meanwhile, she would travel so much, leaving him lonely. And on the other hand, that he would hurt her unwittingly. And it just made me more aware of the flexibility and the need in marriage to know that bad things can happen. But if you're going to stay with somebody, you want to be able to somehow be able to forgive and truly forget something that bad had happened in the past. And I suppose what's happened with Lincoln is something even deeper than any of those, which is that by living in the presence of a man of such character and all the ways in which he really did try to be a good person as well as a great leader, it does make you think when you're about to be mad at somebody, well, maybe I'll write a hot letter against them instead. It does make you think when you may be obsessing about something that hurt you in the past, it's not worth it, as Lincoln would say. Personal contention eats away at our everyday. So that I often do find myself saying, well, what would Lincoln do in this situation? And not a public situation or a political one, but more a private one. And usually the answer is that whatever Lincoln did was better than what I was thinking of myself. So, I mean, I could have lived with this man another 10 years. I must say, I felt in a certain way, when you move from one person to another, you do sometimes feel like you're betraying them. When I had to leave Roosevelt behind to go to Lincoln, and I had to move all my Roosevelt books out of my study because I had to move these enormous numbers of Lincoln books in, I felt like I was being somewhat of a traitor to Roosevelt. And then I have this horrible image that in the afterlife, all the presidents I've studied will be on a panel, and they'll all be telling me every single thing I got wrong. And then even worse, Lyndon Johnson will be the first one to speak up, and he'll be yelling out, how come that damn book on the Kennedys was twice as long as the book you wrote about me? So the great thing about being an historian, I think, is that you do, especially because you're living side by side with these people, and you do feel like you're over their shoulder and you're in their shoes and you're walking with their wives and their children and their families, you do absorb their characters. I could never write a book about Hitler or Stalin. I'll let somebody else do that. I have to basically want to live with the people that I'm writing about. And luckily, the people I've chosen have been people that I basically feel, even with their flaws, I have respected and feel affectionate for. So it's been a great profession. And as I say, I'm so, so grateful for these curiously intertwined loves of history and baseball that have led me to this. And if I could just end on one baseball story that some of you know, but I was asked, at last night I was giving a lecture in San Francisco, and I was asked who was my favorite player. And the story I told that is in my memoir has to do with Roy Campanella. And when he was the first Brooklyn Dodger outside of Ebbets Field that came to my hometown of Rockville Center, Long Island, that I would see in person. And it was so exciting. I was 7 years old, and I was in training for my first Holy Communion. And the problem was, however, it was announced that he was going to be speaking in a Protestant church. Now, when you're brought up as a Catholic, you think if you ever set foot in a Protestant church, you will be struck dead at the threshold. So I went to my father in tears and said, what are we going to do? And he said, don't worry, he's speaking in the parish hall. We're sitting on folding chairs. He's talking about sportsmanship. It's not a religious service. We really can go. But as I went over the threshold that night, I could feel my knees buckling beneath me. And then when I went home, I was afraid that I'd somehow traded the life of my everlasting soul for this one night with Roy Campanella. So a few nights later, I was still not sleeping too well. And there were a whole outburst of sirens, one after the other and the other. Some huge catastrophe, it seemed, had happened in our town. And it turned out that two trains had collided at our village station with a lot of injuries. So the whole town was going to the train station to see if they could help. When I began to discern in this horrible calamity the opportunity for my redemption, because it turned out that in catechism class we had also learned that if somebody were dying and you, a layperson, were present and no priests were there, you could baptize them, they could go to heaven, and all your sins would be wiped out. So I had been practicing on my doll for months in hopes that I might be needed. But never was it more necessary than when the sin of Roy Campanella was on my soul. So I went with everybody to the train station. The only thing that prevented me from the utter humiliation of lifting up blankets and asking injured people if they wanted me, a 7-year-old, to baptize them was that there were a dozen priests already on the scene, so I knew I wasn't wanted or needed. So I went home with this sin still on my soul, and 2 weeks later went to my first holy confession. I decided strategically to tell the priest right away and get it over with. He said there wasn't a sin. It wasn't a religious service, so all those nights of worrying were for naught until, he said, and what else, my child? And then I had to admit that I wished harm to others. And he said, what do you mean? And I had to admit that I wished the various New York Yankee players would break their arms, legs, and ankles so that the Brooklyn Dodgers could win their first World Series. And I remember he said to me, how often do you make these horrible wishes? And I had to say, every night when I say my prayer. So then he said to me, look, let me tell you a secret. I love the Brooklyn Dodgers too, but someday they will win fairly and squarely. Do not need to wish harm on others to make it happen. Oh, yes, I said. But as I left the confessional, he said to me, say a special prayer for our Brooklyn Dodgers. Well, how lucky it was that my first confession was to a baseball-loving priest, but it took a lot of prayers because every year it seemed the Dodgers found some way to lose at the very last moment until finally, in 1955, our dreams came true. So in my whole lifetime, I've had two World Series. 1955, which I was able to share with my parents. My father was working in Brooklyn. He called my mother and me, said, come to the city right away. The celebration will be unforgettable. It was. People dancing in the streets. A bus driver tried to get through us crowds on the street, simply abandoned his passengers and joined us revelers. And I would remember that night forever, shared with my parents, especially because my mother died shortly thereafter when I had just turned 15, and my father died in my 20s. But then when the Red Sox won in 2004, it was the opposite. I was able to share that with my children, all of whom have become these irrational Red Sox fans. And there's a sense in which, as Mr. Moores knows, and as everybody in this beautiful park knows, there is no sport like baseball for the link that it provides for the generations. This gorgeous stadium that I was able to see today, I mean, even just being here again makes my heart quicken for spring to come quickly so that baseball can begin again. So with that, let me thank you all very much for being here.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this and other UCTV programs, visit us online at www.uctv.tv.